All right, some fascinating stuff is going on in the Bible today. Chapter 25, verse 19. Okay, we're in chapter 25, verse 19, which is the beginning of the parasha of Toldot. So, depending on where you are, if you have the Eitz Chaim, which some of you do, and I hope it's one that you have purchased and not taken from the synagogue, because that would be theft. And that's really, right, then you should not do that. Then it is on page 146. Okay, page 146 in the Eitz Chaim. First of all, it says, this is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. That's just the beginning. Now, what strikes you about that beginning? First of all, it is what's called in biblical studies and probably also in literary studies, resumptive repetition. That is, I'm going to repeat what happened before because I'm resuming the story. In the same way that in a television episode, you get, you know, last week on The Wire, right? And then you'll tell you all the things that happened on The Wire. Second thing that you will notice about this, conveniently open to the right page, sure. The second thing you'll notice about this is what? It says, this is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham, and then it goes on to say, Abraham begot Isaac. What strikes you about that phrase, Abraham begot Isaac? First of all, let us turn to our five books of Miriam. Remember from a couple of, yes, I brought them back. They have recurred. Our daughters ask, why does the Torah name only Abraham as Isaac's parent? As it is written, this is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham, which is, by the way, it's not nice for Isaac and it's not nice for Sarah, right? It's like this is Isaac, but really, who is he? What's his story? His story is he's the son of Abraham, which is not how someone usually, you know, it's always a double-edged sword when you introduce somebody by their parents. After all the attention paid earlier to Sarah's barrenness, the first thing we learn about her and to her miraculous fertility in old age, the narrator now erases her from Isaac's genealogy. Likewise, the Torah now revises Rebekah's genealogy, cutting out Milcah, Rebekah's grandmother, because she's identified as daughter of Betuel, Aramean of Padan Aram, sister of Lavan. Why have the women disappeared from the family tree? The sages in our own time, that is modern scholarship, says what? The priests who stitched the Torah together were concerned with the male lineage. Right? That's what a modern scholar would tell you. Bruria answers, what? Rather than suspect the meddling hand of priestly sexism, what's the subtext? What a problematic hero Isaac is for the biblical narrator. He's a mama's boy, a pawn, a victim sandwiched between the conflicts of Sarah versus Hagar, Rebekah and her older son, Rachel and Leah. Given how dominant and powerful the women are in Isaac's life, and how embarrassing such a history must be to such a patriarchal culture, the Torah is trying to make a man out of him, calling on all the male figures in his line, okay? Which is kind of an interesting, I mean, I don't know that that's the interpretation, but it's kind of an interesting interpretation. I thought I would give it a shot.
You call that spin?
That's right, you do call it spin. That's like someone sent me, and then I sent it out to a bunch of people. Andy Borowitz, who is an internet, he writes humor columns, sometimes they're in the LA Times and the Wall Street Journal. He wrote this column about how Hillary's going on a crying tour on each city, right? She's going to be, and it's the same thing is that was so interesting about that whole event was how it got spun and then how it got respun once people realized how it played. Everybody said, oh my God, it's terrible, she cried. Then she won the election, everybody said, well, it's wonderful, she cries, she's human. Which is why pundits are, you know, really problematic, right? You explain something and then when it doesn't turn out, you explain why it didn't turn out the way you said it was going to. It's great business. So, by the way, religious people do the same thing, right? Religious people say, be good and you will be rewarded, and then when you're good and you get it in the neck, they say, God is testing you, right? I mean, it's not so different. Okay. So, right, exactly. It's a good business. Now, who's going to prove you wrong? So,
and you're taping.
I am taping. Yes, so this is... By the way, when I'm leaving here, I'm erasing, but I'm okay. All right. So, now, Isaac was 40 when he took to wife Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. This is the only time that we know of that a man pleads for his wife in barrenness, even though barrenness is very common. Barrenness includes Sarah, Rachel, the mother of Samson, Hannah, the Shunammite woman in Kings, and this is the only time that the husband prays. Now, why is it that that the husband prays in particular? They have a nice, she says in here, where is it? Probably because Isaac, I'll tell you what it says. First of all, this is the only story in which the active parent endeavoring to have the son is the man, not the woman, right? You never hear Rebecca saying, please God, give me a child, the way Sarah does. You have Isaac saying, please give her a child. Now, first of all, it may be because Isaac needs to pass on the lineage. Second, it may be because Isaac doesn't have a concubine. Isaac is monogamous, unlike Abraham and unlike Jacob. Isaac is monogamous, and therefore he prays for his wife, which is a beautiful lesson in and of itself, right? And I think that you can also think, if our picture of Isaac is true, which is he is in some ways weak, but he's clearly the most sensitive in some ways too, right? I mean, he's very at the mercy of his children, as we see later, then maybe he is the empath of the patriarchs, and he really feels Rebecca's pain and prays for her. Now, why doesn't Rebecca pray for herself? Maybe she doesn't want a child, right? In fact, there's a whole line of interpretation that Rebecca believes she comes from wicked people, Laban and his family, and doesn't want to perpetuate those kinds of people in the world, that she's afraid to have a child, that she's not sure her children will be good. And in fact, she gets Jacob and Esau. It's a very, you know, iffy sort of proposition. But it says, the Lord responded to his plea, and his wife Rebekah conceived. Now, because it's an important piece of information, how long did it take?
1 year.
That's right, because it says Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah has a child, right? What's that? Doesn't say particularly how old Rebecca is. Yes. Yeah.
Isn't there a midrash that says that Rebecca was 4 years old when they got married?
Yes, there are midrashim always that the wives are very little, but that's, I think, to make it plausible, to give them a plausible birth age. But as far as we know, people got married in the ancient world at puberty. They can get betrothed then, but they got married at puberty. That's all our evidence. 11, 12, 13 years old. But by the way, there are two things that I would say about that. One is life expectancy was probably 35 or 40, right? So, you know, nobody was celebrating their 50th anniversary. And second, adolescence is a later development in history because when you hit puberty, you went to work. So you lived as an adult effectively. I mean, bar mitzvah was in fact the sign of getting, you know, of reaching adulthood. Hold on to this for 1 second. The other thing is that Rebecca's barren. It says Rebecca's barrenness is mentioned only in a subordinate clause, which explains Isaac's prayer. If you look at the phrase itself, right? What does it say? Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. But the focus of that sentence is not she was barren, so Isaac prayed. It's Isaac prayed because she was barren, which means that it focuses you on Isaac's prayer, not on her barrenness, because the story of Rebecca's birth is not going to be the barrenness. It's going to be the pain and the struggle that she feels in the birth, which we're about to come to, which is really going to be our subject for today, but that'll take a minute. Yes. Right. Yeah, but we've discussed many times the issue of ages in the Bible, whether they're reliable or not, but You just take it for what it is at the moment. I'm not going to go back into the question. I mean, was Methuselah 969? I will let you decide that on your own. But the issue here with the birth of Rebecca's twins is a very complicated one. And it's complicated for two reasons. One is the issue of the twins, and the other is what she says when she has or doesn't have the twins. Okay? So look at the 22nd verse, which is the real 22nd and 23rd are the problematic ones. The children struggled in her womb. So first of all, it's both presaging, and you got to wonder what it is they're struggling about. And she said, "Im kain," which means if so. Lama, why? I'm translating literally. Lama, why? Ze, this anochi, I am. If so, why this I am? As you will note, and as every commentator has noted, this is a fragmentary sentence. It feels like there's something missing. And there's lots and lots of interpretations about what it is Rebecca is saying. One of them I gave you before, which is, if I'm going to have a kid like the family I was born to, why is any of this happening to me? Or if I'm going to have pain in childbirth, such pain, why do this at all? But in order to arrive at a deeper understanding of all this, we need to look first, well, we need to look at several places, but first let's look at Genesis chapter 38. Here you have a story that clearly interacts with the story of Jacob and Esau. Okay? The verse 27, the very end of the chapter. Chapter 38, verse 27. Bless you. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. This is Tamar, and I don't have to go through the whole story of Jude and Tamar. We'll get to it eventually, in 2010. There were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one of them put out his hand. And the midwife tied a crimson thread on that hand to signify this one came out first. Why did the midwife do that? Why do you care? Firstborn, right. Inheritance, firstborn, all of that you have to know. But just then he drew back his hand, and out came his brother. And she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." In other words, you took the lead, basically. So he was named Peretz, which means breach. Afterward, his brother came out, whose hand was the crimson thread, and he was named Zerach. Okay? Peretz actually becomes the ancestor of the Messiah. But first of all, what is the struggle in that womb of Peretz and Zerach?
Who comes out first?
That's right. That's the struggle. The struggle is who comes out first. And once you know that, then you go back to the Jacob and Esau story and you remember that that's the story of their life after they come out of the womb. So what are they struggling about in the womb? Who gets to come out first? And when they come out, what's Jacob doing? He's holding on to Esau's heel. And what color is Esau?
Red.
He gets the red thread, right? The two stories clearly comment on one another. And they're all about who gets to come out first. And just as Peretz comes out first but then loses the birthright, Jacob loses but then wins the birthright. And there is this reversal, which is also a theme throughout the Bible, right? And the theme throughout the Bible, there's more to the Jacob losing and getting. I'll come to that in a second. But the theme throughout the Bible is that the younger child wins over the older child. That's always true. And by the way, although I should really turn the recording off, but do you know who used that theme very effectively? Christianity. When Christianity was born, it constantly talked about how the younger child supplants the older child. That is, Christianity supplants Judaism, because it's a theme throughout the Bible, which is true. It is a theme, right? But in Judaism, leaving Christianity aside, in Judaism, that theme is always seen as the lesser, the weaker, the so on will eventually triumph, right?
I don't know how relevant this is, but it just strikes me as how much are we imposing this competitiveness into these innocent babies? Because I'm thinking for all our life, we're trying to go back to the womb. So if anything, I imagine the baby wants to stay in the womb longer rather than come out of it.
Well, you may well be right. It's what we're doing is we're retro reading. That is, since later they struggled over it and they were struggling in the womb. That's what, you know, that's how you read it. But I mean, if you're going to read it physiologically, probably not. I'm sure that but all mythology is implausible, right? You know, that doesn't read according to the facts of physiology. And this is, I mean, that idea of the two of them struggling is a mythological idea. But there's more to it also, which is she went to inquire of the Lord. She wants to find out from God, right, why this is a problem, why this is happening to her. Maybe not because of the pain, maybe because of her worry about the kids in the womb. And she finds out, by the way. And this is interesting because you remember back in the Garden of Eden, God tells Adam, don't eat from the tree. And he doesn't tell Eve, although it seems like Eve knows, right? But he doesn't tell Eve. And here, God tells Rebekah that the older will serve the younger. But he doesn't tell Isaac. So when Rebekah substitutes Jacob for Esau in the birthright, she knows that's God's intention, but maybe Isaac doesn't know. Maybe, right? Maybe she never mentions it to him. Oh, by the way, God told me Jacob's the one. Or maybe she thinks he won't believe her, right? Because it's clear that she loves Jacob better. So, you know, if you love Jacob better and you come and you say, by the way, it's God told me, he's going to say, right, you know, sure he did. So. Well, wait. We'll see. Yes, we do know why, and we'll get it. I mean, he was a nice boy. He was a quiet boy. He didn't make trouble. He made hospital corners on the bed. So, yeah, that's right. It's the hospital corners. I know. And I know. I was a counselor at camp, and they tried to teach me many times to make hospital corners. She went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord answered her. Two nations are in your womb. Two separate peoples shall issue from your body. One people shall be mightier than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, v'rav ya'avod tsa'ir, that phrase, the older shall serve the younger, has been also a lot of commentary, a lot of ink has been spilled on that phrase. And one commentator actually says that you can read it the other way. V'rav ya'avod tsa'ir means the older will work the younger, as opposed to the older will serve the younger. But I'm not going to get into that. The predominant reading is that the older will serve the younger. So now she has an answer to her question, which is, why does she have this struggle in her womb? And it's because the two of them are at odds and always will be at odds in some way. Now, do you know who the rabbis thought of as Esav? They used Esav as Rome. Edom was Rome. Okay, Esav was, in the rabbinic mind, Rome. So that's who, right, that's who they thought of as the end result of Esav. But that was because the rabbis lived in Rome and hated Rome. And they did, to some extent, our tradition sort of demonizes Esav. He's not such a bad guy, you know, just like Ishmael, right? Esav doesn't go around killing good people or doing anything too terrible. In fact, of the two of them, if you came to this new Jacob and Esau, you would think, who has the better character, right? Esau does. He doesn't steal Jacob's birthright. Jacob steals his birthright. But we will come to that in a minute, because the question of Jacob and his name is very, very interesting and very complicated. Okay, let's just finish this one section, then we'll have a lot to say about it. When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The same phrase, by the way, that is used with parrots that we read before, right? So the Bible is also tying this together verbally, right? If you use the same phrase in two different places, remember that somebody who reads the Bible over and over and over again, as soon as you use the phrase, it's going to click off in their mind the other story. Two twins in their womb. The first one was red, came out red, again, like the red thread that he ties around, that the midwife ties around Zerach's hand, like a hairy mantle all over, right? Aderet Se'ar, which really is like a coat of hair. And he called his name Esav, which may be some play, a little bit, on hair. Then his brother emerged, and it says clearly, V'acharechein, afterwards came his brother, holding on to the heel, Ochezet ba'akev Esav. Now that is, you would think, how he gets the name Yaakov, right? He's holding on to his akev, his heel, all right? So they named him Jacob. So they named him Yaakov. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. Now, the problem is Yaakov means something else, too. What else does Yaakov mean? No, Yaakov does get turned into Israel. That's true. Yaakov, the person, becomes Israel. But what does the word Yaakov mean? If you don't, what's that? No, well, yeah, actually, it does footsteps in footsteps, Akev. But in the Bible, look at, and you will, I hope, remember this. Once Esau finds out, where is it? Chapter 27. Verse 36. Okay. Now, this is after the stealing of the birthright. Esau said, "Was he then named Jacob, that he might supplant me these two times?" V'ya'akveni zeh pa'amayim. Okay. So the other possibility of Jacob means that he supplanted, he took his place. But later on, the word Jacob comes to mean deceit. Because, I'll give you a couple of examples. Now, you don't have to follow me around. I'm going to skip around a little bit. Where is my... I had a thing with all the pages so that I wouldn't bore you by looking for where the pages were. But now I'm, in fact, going to have to do that. Because what's that?
Is it for the green?
No. Oh, here it is. It's in this book. Oh, good. I'm glad. So it'll save you some time. First of all, here is an example from Hosea. I'm just going to give you two examples from Hosea and Jeremiah. Okay? This is from the prophet Hosea, and this is what he says. And this is why, and then why it's important. He says, Babeten. What is Beten? In the belly or the womb. Akav et achiv. He tried to supplant his brother, to take his brother's place. Okay? So then it says, it goes on to say, he strove with an angel and prevailed. So he's talking about Jacob, and he's talking about the fact that in the womb, Jacob was trying to take Esau's place. It took him a while, obviously, to succeed, but in the beginning, he was already trying to do that, and that's the prophet's explanation for the struggle in the womb. And then in Jeremiah, even more explicitly, he says, beware every man of his friend. Okay, I'm going to read you the part in English that you can read in English. Beware every man of his friend. Trust not even a brother. Ki kol ach, because every brother, akov Yaakov, is base in his dealings, is the way he translates it, is tricky, will supplant you. V'chol rea rachil yahaloch. Okay? Every brother takes advantage, and every friend is base in his dealings. I mistranslated the second line for the first. Every brother takes advantage, and every friend is base in his dealings. So there is commentary in later in the prophets that casts retrospectively a light back on Yaakov, which isn't an entirely flattering light. Yeah. You have to speak a little louder. Right.
The
Divine protection for the newly born. Well, that actually, the idea that Yaakov means something different earlier, like protection, is what this essay is all about. This essay from this book that I've mentioned before, Lo Kach Katuv B'Tanach, right, legends that are not written in the Tanakh but are hinted at, is called Ma'i Rabba Eit Leda Tam Shel Yaakov Ve'Esav. What happened at the moment Yaakov and Esav were born? And it says, for example, it gives one or two examples of that same root, akev, meaning guile or trickery in the Bible. And it says, first it compares it to the story in with Peretz and Zerach. And those of you who remember that second story, Judah and Tamar, right? Tamar was supposed to marry Judah's son. A succession of Judah's children died when they were when they married Tamar, so he prevented her from marrying his youngest child, so she disguised herself, remember, as a prostitute, and Judah had children with her. So what does the Midrash say, the rabbis? Two women put a veil over their face and had twins. That's another thing that ties Rebecca. Remember, as soon as she sees Isaac, what's the first thing she does? She puts a veil over her face, right? The two of them hid who they were and as a result had twins, which might mean that two different aspects of themselves were revealed by having twins, right? The Midrash doesn't say what that means. It just says two different women covered themselves and had twins, which I think is, it's one of those phrases that it feels like it ought to mean something very interesting. I'm not sure exactly what it does mean. And then they go on to say that the two stories, that almost one can't exist without the other. That is, you...
Sorry.
Oh, it's someone's phone. That you can't understand the story of Yaakov and Esav without the story of Peretz and Zerach. And you can't understand the story of Peretz and Zerach without Yaakov and Esav. Because the reason the mate ties it around there is you don't want one to supplant the other, right? You don't want one to trick the other in the womb, and you have to clearly identify who is the firstborn. But the firstborn in Yaakov and Esav obviously turns out not to be the one who gets the blessing. Okay, so let me stop there for a second before I talk a little bit more about what Rebecca says, and ask, yeah, for comments.
So, what's the comment about first he took my birthright and then he took my blessing? What's the difference between a birthright and a blessing?
It seems as though he's talking about the fact that we're going to get to the story, but when he talks about when he spurns his birthright with Jacob in the field, that's the property, and then he actually takes his father's, you know, whatever his father blesses him with, right? He steals that too. So, yeah.
You mentioned, excuse me, you started earlier by mentioning that this is all about men and women seem to be left out.
No, only in the first phrase.
Right.
Yeah.
Because a couple of lines later, the rather startling thing occurs is that Rebecca talks directly to God and God
right.
talks directly to her.
Right.
Has that occurred elsewhere in the Bible where a woman has direct conversation with God?
Yes, Sarah. Right before Sarah, when Sarah says, I didn't laugh, and God says, you did laugh. So it does. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Yeah. Also, when God curses Eve at the beginning, at the very beginning, God says, because you did this, right? Because you tricked your husband, you will have pain in childbirth and so on. Sorry, guys. Hagar, too.
The time of the two fighting twin boys relates to me to what you were talking about earlier about Islam. And the fighting, in terms of, I think that America and Western civilization could be looked at as quite a warrior and quite aggressive. And you said it yourself in terms of France and England, but it's also in terms of the United States and our own history. And we tend to project onto the other. And here, what is the horror of Rivka, who is containing both twins, and also in your interpretation, she's saying, I myself come from people who have trouble, which of course is the same people that all the men came from, which they're not containing ambivalence. They're trying to find out who's right and who's wrong and this sort of thing. The woman in containing twins is containing the ambivalence of both sides who might both have good and evil, And it's quite a paradigm right there. I do think that.
So that's a really nice way of thinking about this. First of all, twins in general lend themselves to this kind of thought. You know, there's a large literature on twins. I actually know someone who is writing a book on twins. Abby Pogrebin, who is Letty Cotton Pogrebin. I don't know if any of you know who she is. Right. So her daughter, who did this book called Stars of David, where she interviewed all these famous Jews, she's writing a book on twins. The idea of twins is in literature, it's rife. Like Poe has a book on, you know, the duality, William Wyndham, and it's not clear whether they're twins or not. And I'm actually in the middle of a book called The 13th Tale that is, I don't know if any of you read it, wonderful book about twins, women who are twins. And the idea of twins is that it does allow you to show two different sides of a human being in two different people, but if it's contained in one mother, then it's like it shows both sides of a human being, right? Jacob and Esau both come from Rebekah, so she has both in her, presumably, or Isaac does, or they both do. And it's true that twins are, in some ways, they're the opposite of black and white because they contain both, but in other ways, when they come out, you know, there's an all too unfortunate tendency to identify one as black and one as white. I'm going to leave whether the United States is aggressive aside, because that's a political discussion. I won't get into that one. Yeah.
I'm actually reading this as a really incredible love story between Isaac and Rebecca. And something you said in the beginning about Rebecca feeling like she maybe she didn't want to have children because she came from such rough people.
Right.
And that Esau really does represent her, and Jacob really does represent Isaac. And that she names Jacob with this protective mantle, right? And that she helps Jacob to be the one who is served by his older brother. It's almost as though she's saying, giving a gift to Isaac, saying, you are the better one. You know, he waited and received her. She's the aggressive one, more like
Esau. She's more like Esau and he's more like Jacob.
Yes, but she's ultimately in the end handing him this incredible gift and protecting the gift from the very beginning.
Well, I think that it's clearly the case. And although we're getting ahead of ourselves by talking about the birthright, because we haven't gotten to it yet, but it's clearly the case that the Jewish tradition thinks she does the right thing, right? Because Jacob was the one who was supposed to have the birthright. I don't think that the tradition sees it as an act of love to Isaac, but that's a nice way of reading it, is that it's an act of love to him too, because Esau is not the one to carry on his tradition. And, you know, the whole tradition would have crashed and burned had he bless the one that he wanted to bless, because, and I would say the demographic of this class will allow this to be said, because obviously the wife knows better. I would guess that it is true that in, I don't know, 80, I'll just judge this by, you know, when I ask bar mitzvah parents to describe their children, which I always do at the end of the thing. I talk to the kids, and then at the end I ask the parents to describe the children. As a rule, not always, but as a rule, the mother's observations are more detailed and more, they show a more intimate familiarity with the life of the child than the father's do. And so it's not surprising that Rachel may have known more about Jacob and Esau than Isaac did. You know, Isaac may not have paid such close attention. So, yeah.
So it seems like the question she asks is, why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
And the answer she gets is, why is it happening? It doesn't say why it's happening to her. It's just, why is it happening? It's explaining why the two twins are struggling.
That, yeah, go ahead.
So I'm wondering if that's the paradigm
Right. That, well, I'll say two things about it. First of all, you could see it as it's happening to you because you're the one who can contain this, right? You're the vessel that can make this happen. But But I like the idea that instead of asking why is this happening to me, the better question is why do these things exist in the world? Because that's really the question of theodicy from a philosopher's point of view, not from a sufferer's point of view, right? From a philosopher's point of view is why does evil exist? From a sufferer's point of view is why am I suffering? And, you know, I said this yesterday. Unfortunately, I was behind in my movie watching, so I said this to the eighth grade, and they said, oh, that was in a movie, in Evan Almighty, which I didn't know. But I said to them, just imagine if everybody's prayers came true, right? I mean, the world would be a complete mess, right? I said to them, because I wanted to give an example that wouldn't be so, you know, I said to them, just imagine you're praying that your relatives don't come over for the holiday, and they're praying that they do. What are you supposed to do, right? I mean, how do you grant all the prayers? So it would be impossible that way, and maybe our task as human beings is to explain why the world must be this way, not why individuals must be that way, because you lose that larger perspective of, you know.
Well, there's this old T-shirt, excuse my French, one side said, it talks about different religions in terms of shit happens. Mm-hmm. The Jewish point of view is why does shit happen to me?
Well, you know, that's an old joke about the headline, you know, that scientists discover that a meteor is coming to the earth and everything is going to be destroyed, and the Jewish newspaper reads, world to be destroyed, Jews hit hardest, you know? So that's just the way we think. All right. The two sides of this that are interesting to see is, and are part of our discussion, is that Isaac, on the one hand, is, as we'll see, by far the least written about and most passive of the patriarchs, and Rebecca is the most active and most written about of the matriarchs. So is that, I mean, and in fact, some modern scholars have theorized that actual stories about Isaac have been lost and aren't in the Bible anymore, because there's such a disparity, there's such a difference between the little bit we get about Isaac and how passive he is, and the tremendous stories about Abraham and even more about Jacob, right? Because the story of Jacob is in some ways the most interesting story in the whole Bible, and there's more development and growth in Jacob than maybe any other character in the Bible. He doesn't start out, as we see, so, you know, great in some ways. And his name changes, and he struggles with an angel, and he reconciles, and he has children. I mean, Jacob's story is really, if you think about it, a long, elaborate, fascinating story, and Isaac doesn't get that. So, yeah.
Can it be inferred how Isaac is traumatized?
Well, that's what some people say, is that because of what happened to Isaac at the Akedah, because he was traumatized, or because he was the kind of kid in the first place who could be taken up the mountain. Yeah.
My question is, it says that the Rav Yavotzeim, mm-hmm. and the interpretation is that the older will serve the youngster,
right.
Opposite. If you just read the Hebrew, it says the youngster will struggle in his life.
Right. Well, Rav meaning a lot instead of the older.
A lot of struggle for the youngster.
I would say you could certainly read it that way. It's a beautiful midrash. I think the only reason people don't read it that way is because of the previous verse, which talks about the two of them, and that there's an older and a younger. But I like that idea that, right, it's just talking. It's not anymore talking about Esav. It's just talking about Jacob and saying he's going to have a tough life, which. Which certainly, what's that?
The Israelites from Adam.
Right, and his Jacob is eponymous. That's a good word. If you're ever going to take the SATs again, you may want that word. Eponymous means a name that stands for a people. Okay, so when Midian is born, he's the eponymous hero of the Midianites. Right, like when Romulus and Remus were brothers. Right, Romulus killed Remus and founded the city of Rome. That's why had it gone the other way, it would be Reem, right? So Romulus is the eponymous hero of Rome. Jacob or Israel is the eponymous hero of Israel. Anyway, so yes, it could be that it's just saying that Jacob and by extension, Jacob's people will have a tough life. So, all right. The only other thing that I wanted to talk about in general was to just go back for a second to the brother motif, because Isaac, remember, has experience with a brother, but doesn't have experience with a twin. And the difference is that Ishmael was from a different mother. These are the first brothers, full brothers, that we're dealing with since Abraham's, not the first full brothers that exist, because Abraham has, you know, this passel of children at the end of the last chapter, but the first brothers whose dynamic we can watch that isn't conditioned by the fact that they grew up in different, with different mothers, with different, you know, even different levels of parental attachment. Yeah. Well, I said since Abraham. Oh. No, Cain and Abel, yes, but even Cain and Abel, we don't really get their story, and we don't know their families, and everything up to Abraham. I know this is going to sound, I hope you'll know what I mean, but everything up to Abraham doesn't sound historical quite the same way. It's much more mythological. There were these, it's like Romulus and Remus almost. Remember, Romulus and Remus were raised by wolves, right? It feels mythological. Cain and Abel feel like the archetypes of brothers. We don't know what they fought about. We don't know how they grew up. We don't know what they felt about each other, except obviously Cain wasn't fond of Abel. But with Jacob and Esau, you really get a family picture. And you can identify with it. And that's what makes it so either encouraging or discouraging, depending on how you look at it. That is, all families in the Bible have serious problems from the very beginning of our seeing families, right? Even families that would seem to be, unlike, right, you would say already, well, obviously, Abraham is set up for problems because you can't have a child with your wife and you take a concubine, we can all predict, and then you have a child with your wife, we can all predict that's not going to work, right? But here it seems a match of love, and they have twins, right? And so it's an almost, in some ways, it's an ideal setup. You think everything is going to work. Twins are often very close to one another, right? This book that I was talking about, the Setterfield book that I'm reading, talks about how these twins have their own language, right, which often happens with twins, and yet it's all a mess. So that is, I think, the Bible's very, it's a consistent message, but it is the first time that it tells us how difficult it is, actually, to create a family. Yeah.
But this was all preordained by God. Just Sarah got the message from God
yes.
Got the message from God. Why, in whom? This was going
to yes and no. Again, it's one of those eternal questions. Nothing in the Bible that is preordained by God isn't also interpreted in human terms. Because in a larger sense, everything is God's plan. I mean, we dislike Pharaoh, even though God said Pharaoh's going to object to you. And we like Moses, even though God is the one who chooses Moses. So you can never, in the Bible, looking at human beings, you can never say they have nothing to do with it. It's only God's plan, even though God may decide, yes.
But I'm not saying that. Yeah. It was because God spoke to Sarah, God spoke to Rebecca, and sent to them the younger will, the older will serve the younger in Rebecca's, and that...
That what happened? It's because of that what happened?
That Jacob is the one who she knew that Jacob should have the...
But what I'm saying is that when there's conflict, even if God sets it up, you always judge the human beings too. It doesn't matter that God says, to take a very different example, it doesn't matter that God says to Moses that his children won't serve and Aaron's children will serve as priests and Moses' children don't serve as priests. You still say God said it, but why does God choose those people? What is there in the character of those people? In the same way that all the prophets speak differently, though God speaks to all of them. At least by my inclination, you can never determine a character's actions in the Bible by saying, well, God made it happen. Otherwise, it bleaches the Bible of all significance in some ways. I mean, it's just It's like whether it's like if you believe that human actions are preordained, right? The question of how is it that you have free will if God knows what you're going to do? If you take that question too seriously and you really believe that God knows what you're going to do, then it again bleaches human agency, which is the philosophical term of all choice. All right, let me move on to one other issue, which is the typology that happens afterwards, right? In the very next verse is when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the outdoors, but Jacob was a mild man who stayed in camp. Now, you already know who's going to be the favored child. But if you didn't know who was going to be the favored child, if you could possibly put yourself back into this frame of mind, who would you assume would be the favored child? I would think so, right? I mean, because in a world in which you have to survive, and in a difficult world, and in a world, by the way, which we've already seen Abraham as a military leader, right? Abraham led this battle of the four kings against the five kings, remember? And he won. And that's what saved Lot and got him out of Sodom and so on and so forth. After you see this, then you would assume that Esau would be the one. And later on, by the way, who's the king that's going to bring the Messiah, that's going to be the primogenitor of the Messiah is David, who's also a military leader. So this ideal, the ideal of non-militarism, which we now take for granted in Judaism to some extent, is, I think, very surprising in a way. And this single verse is what signals it coming. That there's a hunter and there's, I mean, a mild man, not, you know, Ish Tom. Tom later on in Hebrew means simple, right? Remember, the Tom at the Passover Seder is the simple son. So Jacob, by the way, is anything but simple. Wholesome? Any other? We've got wholesome, we've got simple, we have mild. Any other translations?
Plain.
Okay. But clearly not, yes. Yeah, well, in modern, in Passover, the ideal of Tom is not knowing, yes. Well, yes, he is, but we don't know that from this verse, right? We know that from the discussion of Yaakov earlier that we had. But from this verse, basically, you can see Jacob as you know, as doing all these schemes in camp. But in fact, Jacob really isn't the schemer here. Who's the schemer? Rebekah. Jacob doesn't say, let me go cheat my father. Right? As we'll see in a minute, Rebekah says, come over here, kid. She schools him in deception. Which is why, and by the way, I just want to, one last reading before we close. Back in verse 50 of chapter 24, two chapters ago, because this was in this Lo Kach Katuv B'Torah, and it just wants to suggest something to you. It says, this is a possible way of reading this story, and since we didn't look at it this way, and I thought it was really interesting, I thought I would mention it. Then, verse 50, then Laban and Betuel answered. Do you have that? It's in Chaye Sarah. If you can't find it, then you can listen to it, and you'll be able to hear also what... The matter was decreed by the Lord. We can't speak to you, good or bad. Here's Rebekah before you. Take her and go. Let her be a wife as the Lord has spoken. Okay? Now, it sounds like Laban and Betuel are saying, here she is. Take her. Go. Right? This is, you know, when Eliezer comes to them. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed low before the Lord. He brought out objects of silver, gold, and garments, gave them to Rebekah, gave presents to her brother and her mother. Then he went and ate and drank and spent the night. Now, what has changed? They've got the stuff. They said, take her, go. Now they have the presents. Okay? Now, if you think Lavan and Betuel are really not nice people, read it this way. When they arose next morning, he said, give me leave to go to our master. But her brother and her mother said, let the maiden remain with us some 10 days. Then you may go. He said to them, don't delay me now that the Lord's made my errand successful. Give me leave that I may go to my master. So they rely on their second alternative. Well, if we can't get him to stay, then let's tell Rebekah and she'll get him to stay. And they said, let us call the girl and ask for a reply. They called Rebecca and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will. Thereby distinguishing herself from the schemes of her family. And if you believe that she thought her family wicked, they said this is a precursor story showing they had the stuff so they didn't care about sending Rebecca anymore. Right? Why do they want to send Rebecca? Now they've got all the stuff. Let marry him off to someone else and make another fortune. But Rebecca didn't play along with their game. And not only did she say, I will, but notice they sent off their sister and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his men, and they blessed Rebecca. And it says right away, then Rebecca and her maids arose, mounted the camels, and followed the man. In other words, she didn't waste any time. Right? She got out of there as soon as she could. And that may also explain in retrospect why she was so willing with Eliezer, because she wanted to get out of that house because it wasn't a good house and she was a good person. Yeah.
At the same time, that like all of us, as much as we want to be so different from our parents, we become...
I hope you're not going to end up by saying we become our parents. because for some people that's a good thing, but for other people...
But she became so manipulative herself.
Do you know what Oscar Wilde said? She did become. She clearly did become part of her parents. Right. Part of her parents are in her, and you can see that all the time. Right. All the time, you see people who distance themselves from their parents, but are their parents. You know what Oscar Wilde said? This is a nice note to close on. Oscar Wilde said, "Every woman becomes her mother. That is her tragedy." Right? He's not done yet. He said, "No man becomes his mother. That is his." That's his tragedy. And on that note, I'll see you next week.